What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping
you? I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Welcome to Call to Communion. I'm your host, David Anders. The number to be on the show is 1-833-288-3986. 1-833-288-EWTN. If you're out of the country, you can call us at 1-205-271-2985. Email us at ctc@ewtn.com. And you can text your question to EWTN. You can text EWTN to 55000. You can also contact us on Facebook Live and the YouTube chat. To ask your question, main line again is 1-833-288-3986. The show is Called to Communion. All people are called to communion with Christ in the church that he founded. And which church is that, Dr. Ray Grindy?
The Third Church of Christ on Fifth Street?
Wrong question. You know, usually
I have multiple choice.
I normally have a facilitator when I do this show, right? You know, but Tom Price is off vacation and taking a well-deserved rest. And today I have Ray Grindy as my friend and colleague, at least for part of the show. He was sitting in the studio when I showed up today,
you know,
so
I
decided,
David,
not to kick him out.
You are the Jeopardy of Catholic media. And I am the, what's the name of the show where you pick a letter? They had Vanna White do the letter thing.
Oh, you know? Good grief. I'm not good with that. Oh, Wheel of Fortune?
Wheel of Fortune. Yeah. Okay. So we go from kindergarten to the PhD. That's what's happening here.
Well, I don't know. There's definitely a lot of Jeopardy, you know, when I'm around, right? So anyway, the theme of the show is what's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? We're all called to communion with Christ, the church that he founded. And this show is mostly for people who are not in the Catholic Church or have left the Catholic Church or have questions about the Catholic Church. If you're not Catholic, you're not Catholic for some reason. And it might be a theological objection. You might have, think the Pope is the Antichrist, or Catholics all think they have to climb to heaven on their own rosary beads, something like that. Maybe you have a family problem, and you've got a wife, a husband, a child that's giving you a hard time about becoming Catholic. Maybe it's political. Maybe you don't like the church's stance on some policy issue in the public forum. Whatever it is, call us and tell us about it. We'd love to chat at, now I've forgotten the number, 1-833-288-3986. So, Ray, before we started the show, I know you were trying to come up with an interesting...
I'm confused about so many things, David, and I'm glad you're here.
Okay, well, thank you. All right. What can I do for you?
Well, you've heard the statistics about the universe. Hundreds of billions of galaxies and hundreds of billions of stars in each galaxy and probably planets all over the place. Now, prior to modern astronomy, we didn't even know that stuff was there. So could you just speculate a little bit on why God might have done that?
So you're thinking that something might be big to God.
Oh, good point. Never thought about that. I just figured God's like 5'9", and then that universe is out there.
Right. Well, you know, actually, this very question that you raised has been raised by Catholic theologians now through the centuries, because we might think that our understanding of the scope or scale of the universe is so much better than what our ancestors had, but they also recognized that there was a scope or scale that dwarfed the human perspective, even when they had the geocentric worldview. They thought the spheres that circled the Earth in this giant dome were massive and celestial and in a completely different sort of dimension from the human realm. And, of course, they speculated beyond that there was an angelic and demonic realm that dwarfed again in scale or scope what humans experienced. So this idea of being a small person in a very big universe, we've fleshed out the details quantitatively a little bit. But that perspective on the transcendent and the finite and the concrete, that's not unique to the modern world. And what St. Thomas Aquinas would have said to that question is that God's infinite. God is infinite. God contains every perfection within himself, and he creates out of his goodness to manifest his beauty, his love, his truth, and his goodness. That's not going to happen with a single starfish.
So it is one way of God saying, check this out.
Check this out. You know, some of the ancients would compare God to light, just as an analogy, in the way a prism can refract light into all the different colors. So by the act of creation, God isolates some particular perfection of his own nature in a very small way, in a concrete particular individual or in a species. And of course, no one of them can capture the beauty, the magnificence, and the glory and the power of God. And so it's necessary to have a multiplication of creatures to begin to, even of any small way, reflect the magnificence of the divine nature.
You familiar with a guy named Stephen Barr?
I am. Not familiar. I mean, I know who he is. Okay. I don't know well.
He's a nuclear particle physicist.
Right.
Barr is a very staunch scientific apologist for the truth of God. Barr said this: from what we can understand, the human being is roughly halfway between the infinity of the universe and the infinitesimality, if that's the right word,
sure,
of the microscopic world, of the
right.
atomic world.
Right.
I don't feel so small. You know that? I don't feel
well,
so small.
You know,
because I am dwarfing those atoms.
And your intellect, well, you know, there's a finite capacity in any given intellect. We can only understand so many things at a given time. But you are ordered in your affections, in your will, in your intellectual activity towards the universal, right? That's what intellectual activity tries to perceive. What is the universal form behind the various particulars that we encounter? And you can rise up in your abstraction to contemplate the very nature of being, which is the broadest category you can think of. And that's actually what the Catholic theologians tells us is the nature of God. God is the very act of being itself.
The fact that you can do that, what you just said, which is kind of a beautifully abstract, logical thought, the fact you can do that means that somehow you can control where your brain goes. You can draw upon what's in your brain. You direct your brain, correct?
That's right.
All right. Now, would we call that the soul? C.S. Lewis says that if there is no God, then what you just did was random. Purely random.
Yep.
And it would make no sense that I would even listen to you because you're random. There's no God. So who directed what you just did?
The argument for God's existence from rationality. Right. Lewis is famous for the argument. Now, my producer is waving at me through
What's
the glass.
What's he waving at? We're having a good talk over here.
We're going to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Wendy in Lafayette, Louisiana, Mary in Portland, Oregon, Tom, and you when you call 1-833-288-3986. Welcome back to Call to Communion. I'm your host, David Anders, with my friend Ray Guarendi, who's with us today. He was kind of hanging around in the studio when we showed up, decided to stick around, and we're happy to have him. You know, Ray, on a lot of shows I listen to on EWTN, mostly because I'm not in my car that much to listen to radio, but when I do, it's usually Ray Guarendi I'm listening to.
All Ray all day.
Mm-hmm. Now, part of that's because you're on when I'm on my way to the
yeah,
studio.
Yeah, this
right?
is pure random. This is not any kind of compliment. This is just random
I'm
driving.
Teasing you. I love your show. Now, listen, we have a call now from Wendy in Lafayette, Louisiana. Wendy, welcome to Call to Communion.
Ah, thank you.
Hi, what can I do for you?
Yeah, hi. I mainly just had a question about Jesus and the Eucharist being
sure.
one and the same thing and not separate.
Okay.
And that possibly in church, what we're being given as a Eucharist or the Holy Communion is actually a placebo. And I've always been hesitant about the Christian religion and to join it and be a member because I feel like it's a topic that isn't discussed, and I feel like it's doing a disservice to the members of the church.
That's a great question. It's one of the best questions I've ever gotten, and I really, really appreciate it. So, first of all, let's define a placebo, right? A placebo is an inert substance that actually has an effect on the recipient, on the patient, because they believe that it will. And that cathartic sort of autosuggestion, which is built into human psychology and human physiology, has a curative power, has an actual measurable statistical benefit. And so it just the efficacy is through the psychology and the physiology but not through, you know, some chemical mechanism like, you know, a drug that's been verified by the FDA. All right, so is the Eucharist a placebo? Well, it certainly could be. It certainly could be, right? Anything can be a placebo. You know, I could hand you a dead fish and tell you it had curative properties, and if I persuaded you that it did and you took it, you would be able to generate a placebo effect. And so if someone were to come to the Eucharist seeking physical healing, or the kind of cure that could be measured in a scientific experiment, control groups and the like, it is certainly plausible that a person could have a placebo effect to the Eucharist given what their expectations were. Now, in point of fact, in Catholic doctrine, the Church actually teaches that the reason we have sacraments, the reason Christ instituted sacraments, is to work on your psychology. Thomas Aquinas is explicit about that. The Eucharist is not magic. We can actually specify the mechanism of its efficacy, and it works through the psychological faculties. It forms your intellect, your will, and your imagination. Now, we also believe it does so aided by the Holy Spirit, but it definitely works on a person psychologically. Now, here's where I think the placebo analysis breaks down, right? I don't come to the Eucharist because I'm seeking physical healing. Right, I don't come to the Eucharist even to seek, say, psychological healing for a particular pathology, like, say, depression or anxiety. Right, I come to the Eucharist because I'm trying to form my will, my intellect, my mind, my imagination, and my character after the likeness of Jesus. Now, if you can come up with a placebo that will do that, I mean, my hat is off to you. Give me a sugar pill that when a person takes it, they become virtuous. I have yet to see the placebo that can do that. And the sacraments are meant to habituate you to a certain way of being in the world. Each sacrament represents to us, and this is psychological, represents to us some mode of entering into communion, of participation with Christ, dying and rising with Him as represented to us in baptism, for example, strengthening and encouraging and a sort of an opening towards the world to share my faith is represented and effected in me by confirmation. Reconciliation with God and neighbor is both demonstrated, exhibited, and effected in me by the sacrament of reconciliation. And the Eucharist represents two things to me. One of them is this life of self-sacrifice, this giving of myself in worship to God and neighbor that Christ demonstrates for me on the cross. It's what we call the Eucharist Mass, the memorial of the death and resurrection of Jesus. It's exhibited to me in the Mass. And then His presence with me, in the real presence in the Eucharist, is also made manifest and present and effected in my life. And when I enter into this sacramental way of being, and I practice the faith over and over and over again, and I call to my mind the truth of the sacraments, the power of the sacraments, the imitation of Christ that it calls me to, and then I habituate myself to that way of being in the world, then psychologically I am transformed. But it's through this infusion of supernatural habit, not through the mechanism of mere autosuggestion, right? And it's possible to go to the Eucharist and believe doctrinally in the truth of the sacraments and not be moved by them. The Church is very clear. It's very possible to have a fruitless participation in the sacraments, not actually be transformed in virtue. Why not? If I don't bring charity, if I don't bring charity to my practice of the sacraments, I will not be transformed by them. The Eucharist will be of no value to me. Now, that's not the way a placebo works. A real son of a gun can take a placebo and you know, be cured from a fake headache. But you can't be a real son of a gun and go to the Eucharist and benefit in that way. You actually have to bring a life of virtue and charity, cooperating with the grace of God. So is there some value in the placebo analogy? Yeah, perhaps. Does that cover the whole of the Church's doctrine on the Eucharist or the way that we experience it to grow in grace and virtue? I think not. I hope that's helpful to you, Wendy, and I appreciate the call. The number to be on the show is 1-833-288-EWTN, 1-833-288-3986. Let's go now to Mary in Portland, Oregon. Mary, welcome to Call to Communion.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks for calling.
So I am a Catholic, but my husband, he went to Catholic schools and has received his sacraments and all of that thing. And so on paper, he is a Catholic. But the life that he seems to be leading is kind of the opposite of what we strive for. And we have, he's has an addiction issue and things like that. And there's a lot of character assassination and things like that in our home directed at me and the children. And
I'm so sorry.
I just don't know. I feel like this is a cross that I need to bear because our church, our marriage is sacramental. And I do think that it is making me a more virtuous person, which I'm very thankful for. But I don't know what to do to help bring him home. He doesn't go to Mass with me. If he does go to Mass, he gets upset at the children for making, like, noises or wiggling if four children. So I don't know if there's anything that you could point me to or help, you know.
Yeah, I can. And listen, I'm really sorry. This is obviously very painful. I'm deeply sympathetic to your plight. I can tell this is hurting you, and I'm so sorry, and you're in our prayers, all right? We have a great concern for you, because this is not an uncommon problem that you've described, and it's very, very difficult. The first thing I'd like to suggest to you is that this is not your fault, and this is not your responsibility. You are not going to be held accountable by God for your husband's vices. That's not on you. You ask, what can you do to bring him back to the church? Well, you know, Christ tells us we are to be lights, not hammers. And what you are doing right now, you're trying to be faithful. You're trying to be in the Mass, be in the sacraments, raise your children well, love and forgive and be patient. That's what you do. That's what you do, right? And you can't compel him to change his mind or his behavior. Now, paradoxically, the more we dig in sometimes and try to change people, the more they're going to dig in and resist us. Now, there are a few other things you can do that I'd like you to... I'm not telling you to do this. I'm just laying out the options for you. The fact that you are in a sacramental marriage, right, and that if it's a valid marriage, and that, of course, is not for me to determine, well, then you're married for life. That doesn't mean that you are under an obligation necessarily to maintain conjugal living or cohabitate, because you mentioned that your husband has an addiction problem. Now, one of the reasons that the church would contemplate the possibility of living apart, even in the case of a valid marriage, is if one of the spouses is engaged in an intrinsically immoral activity that puts the children or the spouse in danger, either physically or morally. And so if your kids are exposed to something that puts them in danger, and the danger could be scandal to the faith, but it could also be their own physical safety, you know, or their psychological well-being if it's really catastrophic, and they're in danger, the church would say you could ask him to move out, or you could move out, or you can separate in order to keep the family safe. Now, if you're validly married, you maintain an openness, the possibility of reconciliation down the line. But you're not called to be a doormat and let him abuse his family. That's not your obligation. Now, I know we're blessed today on the show. We've got somebody who is an expert in exactly these kind of family dynamics. Dr. Ray, do you have anything to add?
If he is upset with you because you're trying to live the faith, I would suggest you don't ask him to go to Mass with you, and you don't let him see that you're at your best and happiest when you're talking to your friends from church, because he will compare that. Oh, you're just so nice to your friends from church, but with me, what I would suggest is if you show him, and this is kind of what David was saying, if you show him that your faith is making you easier to live with, you're kinder toward him. You're more forgiving toward him. You're just an overall better human being to be around. That's probably what you can do to win him over more than anything else.
Yeah.
That's tough. For heaven's sakes. I would also say this to you, dear. You can't take anything he does personally. You can't. Whatever he says, whatever he criticizes, however that is, you take that personally, you're going to be miserable. You can look at him and say he's a very unhappy, miserable person as I see it. I wouldn't want to be in his mind right now. And that might soften you up toward him.
Yeah, thank you. Mary, I hope that helps. Thank you for calling today. The number to be on the show was 1-833-288-3986. 1-833-288-3986. Don't forget, you can also text us on the YouTube chat, Facebook Live. Let's go now to Tom in, I don't know how to say the name of your town in Texas, Tom.
It's New Braunfels, Texas.
Okay, New Braunfels, Texas. Welcome to Call to Communion.
Thank you. It's right between San Antonio and Austin. Okay, quick question. A friend of mine who's not Catholic brought this up, and I didn't really have an answer for him. And he pointed to 2 Corinthians 12, where Paul is talking about, quote, "I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know." So I don't recollect or know of any other definition that there's other than that there's one heaven. So I didn't really have an answer. So what's your take on that? Are there three heavens? What's the Catholic definition of heaven as it applies or compares to this paragraph?
Yeah, sure. So I appreciate the question, by the way. Even in modern English, we use the word heaven ambiguously or analogously. We can use the word heaven to refer to the heavens, you know, the realm of astronomy. We can also talk about heaven as the abode of the righteous dead with God. And while I don't claim to have perfect knowledge about St. Paul's cosmology and what his view of astronomy was, that seems to be what he has in mind, that he is distinguishing the heavens as an astronomical phenomenon from the realm of the holy angels and the blessed dead with God. And he claims he wasn't traveling out by Jupiter or on Mars. He had a vision of God of some kind, some sort of mystical experience. Is that helpful to you?
A little bit more I need in terms of, because it sounds a little bit more specific as far as levels, and I've seen other denominations focus in on this.
Sure,
and
sure.
Run with it.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you in the whatever St. Paul's cosmology was, whatever specific beliefs he had about astronomy and the position of the earth with respect to the planets and the heaven, none of that is now presently a subject of Catholic dogma. And the way the Catholic Church understands the creation, the created order, including the created heavens, is simply this. God made the world and everything in it, spiritual and physical, in one definitive act. And in terms of working out the intricacies of the cosmology, that's something that science can do to a certain extent. But in terms of the abode of the dead, we really shouldn't think of it in terms of spatial location right now, not until the resurrection, because our disembodied souls will not have won't have spatial location or extension in space. They won't have bodies. And the experience of the blessed dead is that of the beatific vision, namely the knowledge of God in his essence. And it's not restricted to any sort of place or time necessarily, not until the resurrection of the dead in which God recreates the heavens and the earth. And so I wouldn't get too hung up on the cosmological question in St. Paul. He's obviously referring to a concept that was familiar to his audience, but is not a subject of Catholic dogma. And so it just doesn't matter. But I appreciate the question. All right, the number to be on the show is 1-833-288-3986. 1-833-288-3986. We've got a question from Leah when we come back from our break. And one from you if you call 1-833-288-3986. Seems like physics. Welcome back to Call to Communion. I'm your host, David Anders. The number to be on the show is 1-833-288-3986, 1-833-288-3986. I have a text question here from Leah, YouTube question. Leah says, how do Catholics combat the line of thinking that some Jewish people put forth, saying that Christian use of the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible is a form of cultural or religious appropriation. Interesting. So, you know, clearly, Christ appropriated the Old Testament. Absolutely. Of course he did. And he offered, to say the least, an idiosyncratic interpretation, one that violated the norms and standards and categories of many of the Jews of his day. Now, Christ identified as a Jew. He was Judean, Hebrew, descendant of Abraham, descendant of David, and he had every right as part of his cultural patrimony to lay claim to the Old Testament, inasmuch as any Jew would have. And idiosyncratic interpretations were not unique to Jesus. There were other Jews of the day that offered sort of alternative explanations or accounts of how to construe the Old Testament and its significance. So in that, Christ was not unique. Now, where Christ was unique was he claimed a unique authority. He imbued his interpretation with a unique authority, the authority of God himself. And that was the radical claim. But Christians did not invent our interpretation of the Old Testament. Christians appropriate, if you will, Christ's interpretation of the Old Testament. So if you're going to have fault with someone, take fault with someone in the Christian tradition for how Christians utilize the Old Testament, you have to have fault with Christ, because he's who we learned it from. And of course, Christ himself was a Jew. So I don't really think you can make the charge that this is somehow a Christian appropriation of a Jewish book, given that Jesus Christ was a Jew. That's how I would respond to that.
There is a phrase in psychology, I don't totally agree with it, David, but it says, everything is always about something else. So when somebody says, well, you're appropriating the Old Testament, it almost seems to me that they are saying, I really don't believe at all what you Christians say.
Yeah, sure.
So I have to find some way to invalidate you, and that's a convenient one.
You know, I personally don't quite understand the cultural mindset that views appropriation as a sort of insult or slight.
It's like we used to be positive about it. You're imitating. Flattery, sincerest form of flattery is imitation. It used to be a good thing. It's all part of the offense. We're just all so offended so easily. And if you do anything that is mine, I'm 3 years old, don't take my anything, I get angry.
I did not grow up listening to bluegrass music. I did not. Even though I'm from the South, I didn't grow up listening to bluegrass. And I have recently taken an interest in bluegrass.
I was listening to
Doc Watson this morning, you know, Tennessee Stud on the way in. And I can't think of a higher form of flattery than to appreciate and try to make use of, to enjoy, a cultural form that I did not invent and was not common in my family.
All goes back to, I define how I will be offended.
There you go.
And if that's an offense to me, I declare it.
All right, the number to be on the show is 1-833-288-3986, 1-833-288-3986. We have a caller who mentioned, okay, I'm sorry, that wasn't a question. Tony on YouTube asks, do we remain members of the church when we are in hell, and when do we lose this membership? Yeah, thanks. That's a really interesting question, Tony, because in Catholic doctrine, baptism, as you know, does three things. Baptism makes us members of Christ's body, which is the church, and that's that baptismal character that you will hear about, that is imprinted and fused into your soul that you cannot lose even in the state of mortal sin. Then there is the washing away of virginal sin and the infusion of sanctifying grace that can be lost if we return to mortal sin. And then, of course, baptism makes us priests. We're a kingdom of priests, baptismal priests, to offer the sacrifice of our lives, body and soul, to God, right? So one thing is clear, mortal sin does not remove that baptismal character. And so presumably, although I haven't asked anyone there, in hell, we can be identified as a member of Christ's body who defected to mortal sin. Now, you know, that's a pretty attenuated notion of belonging to Christ, because you're eternally separated from him. So I don't know at that point that it makes any sort of ontological difference in your status the way it does in this life. What being a member of Christ's body now in this life avails you of the sacrament of reconciliation. I mean, that's the real benefit, that even if you depart in mortal sin, the church is yours. You are there. It's there for you. You have a right, a claim on the sacraments and the ministrations of the church in order to reconcile you. Now, in hell, that ceases to have any sort of relevance because you're not going to get reconciled. Number to be on the show, 1-833-288-3986. 1-833-288-3986. Roger asks, what other sources do you have for the psychological value of the Eucharist? Book by Abbot Vonier, V-O-N-I-E-R, called The Key to the Doctrine of the Eucharist. The Key to the Doctrine of the Eucharist by Abbot Vonier. One of the best books in English on the nature of the Eucharist and precisely its nature as a sacrament, i.e. its capacity to work on our soul, on our psychology, explicating the doctrine of St. Thomas Aquinas. Abbot Vonier, Key to the Doctrine of the Eucharist.
David, all right. When I came back to the church, one of the things that struck me about the Eucharist is why would you make up something so dumb in the early church if you're attempting to gain converts? Why would you say we have to eat him? Why would you do this? Why can't you just say it's a memorial meal, like where I was in the evangelical world, where you were in the Protestant
right,
world?
Absolutely.
We know that historically that's what they believed. We have the historical fact that they all believe that. What? Don't make that up. That's really ridiculous. You're trying to start a new religion to get converts, and you're telling people you got to eat him? I said, it's so ridiculous, it's got to be true.
You know, Ray, I'm glad you mentioned that. There's an analogous problem for the one who would attack Catholic doctrine. And that's the idea of the communion of saints and the veneration of their relics. And if you were like me, coming up in evangelicalism, Protestantism, you often heard, I did, that the Catholic veneration of saints and their relics was a holdover from paganism. That pagans had brought this to their practice of Christianity, but the pure, the pristine early Christians did not do that.
Uh-huh.
Then I went and read the history, and I found the exact opposite to be the case. The thing that offended the pagans the most about Christians, especially in the—
We took their stuff.
No.
Well, we made it holy.
Well, we did that, but the pagans didn't actually venerate the relics of dead people. Right? What offended the pagans about the early Christian church was precisely the Christians' insistence on carrying around dead bones. Because in the pagan mindset, burial was something unclean, profane, and you had to keep it radically separate from worship. And so in Roman law, the cemeteries were outside of town. The temples were in the town. Worship was part of civil religion to establish the government and peace, and you want to have the gods on your side. And they didn't have a moral purity they brought to the temple, but they had a ritual purity they thought they had to bring. And that required that dead people and their bones be far away from them. And so here come the Christians worshiping in the cemeteries, offering the Mass on the bones of the martyrs.
Don't do that if you want to win converts, if it's not true.
Carrying bones back into the city. And the pagans went, ooh, yuck. Ooh, yuck. That wasn't a bid to attract pagans.
Yeah.
Right? That was born of the Catholic doctrine of the dignity of the body and the resurrection of the dead. And Christ's teaching that we're all members of his body. We venerate Christ in his members.
It's like the women at the tomb. Don't say the women were the first ones at the tomb. That's a culture that didn't believe women.
They didn't accept their
testimony. Don't say that unless it's true.
So we have a call now from Tom in El Paso, Texas. Tom, welcome to Call to Communion.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a first-time caller, and I listen to your show all the time. And I just felt compelled to call in today because both you guys are on there at the same time, and just, wow, what a treat. I missed the beginning of the show. I don't know if this is a schedule or whatever, but it's just awesome. If you guys could find a way to do it more often, that would just be awesome.
We're going to make Ray move to Birmingham. That's how we're going to do this. So, Ray, thanks for being here today.
Hey, I tell you, David, I just learned so much from you. Now, sometimes you use those words I don't understand. I have to go look them up. I got to have my dictionary with me.
It irritates my wife. We were talking this morning.
You're pedagogical. And, perusing voluminous eclectic tomes.
Do what? Anyway, Tom, thanks so much for the call. We really appreciate it. I think Dr. Ray's pretty awesome, too. I'm glad he's on the show with us today. Thank you so much. The number to be on is 1-833-288-3986. 1-833-288-3986. I can feel my sense of humor like rising by degrees just being with you, Ray.
See, your sense, that's very kind of you to say that because my wife says I bring people down to an eighth grade level.
Well, that's about my speed. It's about my speed. Okay, Steve, we got Steve in Shelbyville, Kentucky. Steve, welcome to Call to Communion.
Hey, David, how you doing?
Fine, thanks. How about you?
I'm doing well. I have a question. It's been a while since I called you. I'm the one that's waiting for you to come to Kentucky so we can go out and have coffee and tea.
Great.
I have a question. I have a lot of, you know, there's a lot of people throw around the word unconditional love a lot. And, you know, of course, God loves us unconditionally, but they use it in the sense that nothing we can do can turn us from God, if that makes sense. So my question was, does God still love people that are in hell?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So first of all, remember that God doesn't change at all. Not at all. No, not in any respect. The Catholic position is God does not have moods. God doesn't move from being happy to being sad, or move from being angry to being calm, or being joyful to being somber. God, in Catholic understanding, does not even have discursive thoughts. God does not reason to a conclusion, because that would require, you know, premise, conclusion. It would require sequence in the divine mind. The passage, the procession of one thing to another. God doesn't even reason discursively. God simply knows everything in a single permanent instant. He is utter simplicity and constancy and does not in any shape, form, or fashion change. Now, God's nature is love. But we have to be careful to define love. What is love? Love is benevolence and a desire for union, that I want your genuine integral good, and I want to be united with you in that good. And that disposition that God has is constant, eternal, and unchanging. What does change is our receptivity to that. And, you know, if you take the analogy of the sun beaming down, there its light is beautiful and warm and life-giving and health-giving. That really doesn't change. But I can go outside and put up an umbrella and block out the light of the sun. The sun's still there. It's still doing its business. But I'm the one that's blocking it out. Now, I can put the umbrella down and let the sun shine on me. And in the life of faith and the life of morality, that's the equivalent of conversion. I can turn my face towards God and be receptive of his unchanging, unconditional love. Unconditional is a little bit of a funny word. I don't know that I'd use the word unconditional. That's really not a biblical word. It's not really the way Catholics think about it. It's not that God changes. It's not that God's passing in and out of a state of love for me. But there are conditions on me to my receptivity to that. Namely, I have to be turned towards him. Right. And when I do turn toward God, the effect in me is charity. God's love pours into my heart as I gaze on him. And then I'm able to live a charitable life, love God and love neighbor. Now, what happens if I turn away from God? Well, I just cut off the flow of light. And hell is God respecting my choice. God is not the one that changes, but the soul in hell chooses to turn permanently away from God. Anything to add, Ari?
If there's no mood, David, then how do you explain in the Old Testament God was angry, or God was distraught, or God was upset, or God didn't like?
Sure. Well, I mean, the Catholic position on this is that the Bible uses anthropomorphic language of God. I mean, it describes God in figures drawn from human experience, like when the book of Genesis says that God walked in the garden with Adam and Eve. Well, God doesn't have feet. He doesn't have any feet. It's a figure. It's a figure to represent God's intimacy with Adam and Eve.
So that's our attempt to understand
sure.
the nature of
and,
God.
Sure, and we can certainly experience God in something like anger, like passion. If I sin and I'm deeply alienated from my own true nature, from love itself, then I can feel wrath. I can feel the effects of something that feels like wrath. And to use that kind of language to describe God in a figure is appropriate, but it's not, say, philosophically precise. And the Scripture communicates in a lot of ways, usually not in philosophical treatises, oftentimes in stories and narratives, sometimes in poetry, because the purpose of the Bible is not to be a theology textbook. It's to work on my mind, my will, my emotions, and imagination to form me in a certain kind of character. Now, the Catholic tradition, Catholic intellectual tradition, the patrimony of the Church, is to try to understand that and integrate it with the life of reason. And so theology has a perspective on these things that's broad and profound, but I can actually engage the book as a story and let that anthropomorphic figurative language work on my imagination. And that's how Bible functions in our life.
I felt very godly when you were talking about our Lord doesn't have to reason from point A to point B to point C, because I don't do that very well either. So maybe that's a godly thing.
Well, you know, Jesus tells us we have to be like little children. Right? You know?
My wife, if that is the criterion, I'm there.
Well, you do have to add charity to that.
There you go, complicating the picture.
All right, the number to be on the show is 1-833-288-3986. 1-833-288-3986. Let's go now to Anthony in Saddlebrook, New Jersey. Anthony, welcome to Call to Communion.
Hi, Dr. Landers. Love your show. Thank you for taking my call. I am a cradle Catholic, and I have an extended family member who is fallen away from the church or is in the process of falling away. And he had asked me a question that I couldn't really answer. And the question was, what do a bunch of guys that are celibate know about sexuality?
A lot.
How to give advice?
Yeah, they know a lot. Okay, so first of all, you're assuming that celibate means virgin. That's not a good assumption. The Catholic priest, bishop, theologian, and doctor of the church who wrote the most about celibacy was also one of her most profligate wayward sons, and that was Augustine of Hippo. Augustine lived the first 30 years of his life as a sex addict. He lived as a sex addict, and he was tortured by his sexuality and found it a tremendous burden and suffered greatly and did injustice against other people. He treated his concubine atrociously, and he conceived a child out of wedlock and said of his son Adeodatus that I had no part in this child other than the sin. Now, that's not exactly true. As they got older, they used to have philosophical conversations. But Augustine knew corrupted and deficient sexuality from the inside out. And for him, the life of celibacy, of continence, was a profound liberation. And he couldn't do it. He couldn't come to that level of peace and equanimity and inner harmony until he had embraced the Catholic faith. So for him, Catholic celibacy was a profound relief in comparison to this tumultuous whirlwind of sexual passion that he had lived with. Other saints have had similar experiences. Now, you know, I would also say that a person who is sexually experienced, but in this kind of self-indulgent way like Augustine, probably has the worst possible perception of human sexuality. You know, who do I want to receive instruction from in the sexual life? The virtuous man or woman who has mastered his passions and placed his or her sexuality at the service of neighbor, or the one who has made a habit of selfishly indulging their sexuality at the cost of other people's humanity?
David, I'm not an octogenarian. I'm not a woman.
Right.
As far as I know, I am not mentally ill. I've had no drug or alcohol problems. I've not had in any way time in jail. If I were to have to experience every single thing to give anybody advice about anything, I'd be limited to older middle-aged guys that have been married to the same woman. That's about it.
Yeah.
When someone says, remember we talked earlier in the program, everything's about something else.
Mm-hmm.
When someone says, what are those celibate guys going to tell me about sex? What they're really saying is, I don't want to hear what they have to say.
That's right.
I have never, ever in my life as a psychologist met someone, when I said something to them that they agreed with, ever said, well, who are you to tell me? As long as they agree with what I'm going to say to them, it doesn't matter what experience I've had.
Who would you rather listen to about sex? A priest who has violated his vow of continence or one who has kept it?
I was in a group once. Guy was in jail. And he said to me, what are you going to tell me about being in jail? You ever been in jail? I said, no, I'm married, but no. I said to him, maybe because I haven't been in jail, I can give you some good advice about not being in jail.
Right. I'm an expert on not being in jail.
Yes. That is the biggest, as a psychologist, that is probably the number one way people invalidate advice they don't want to hear.
Yeah.
Who are you to tell me because you don't have my experience?
That's right. That's right. Is that helpful, Anthony?
that actually helped a lot. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. The number to be on the show, 1-833-288-3986. 1-833-288-3986. We have got a couple of YouTube questions and Facebook questions. Bradley writes, I just bought an English translation of Dante's Divine Comedy, Augustine of Hippo's The Confessions, St. John's, and I can't, that question got cut off. Ascent of Mount Carmel, Faustina's Diary, and I've been Catholic for 6 years. Am I ready to read this stuff? And what level of magisterial learning these works have?
I'll tell you what, I struggle to read it. I've been a Catholic for 60.
Okay, all right. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so first of all, different levels of authority. When you're reading Augustine, you are reading a doctor of the church. And that means that the church has elevated Augustine to a position of an official teacher. And Augustine will not lead you astray. You can trust Augustine. Doesn't mean he's right in every particular, right? But Augustine's way of approaching doctrinal and moral questions is totally consonant with the Catholic faith. And he is an exemplary thinker and writer about Catholic issues. So Augustine will not lead you astray. St. John of the Cross is also a doctor of the church. So he will not lead you astray. Dante is not a doctor of the church. He's a celebrated poet. But this is a work of poetry. This is the fine arts. This is a work of imagination. And while he has many moral and theological insights that are valuable, it's not to be classed with Augustine or with John of the Cross. Now, as a model of poetry, yes, fantastic. For theologian is not the same caliber as Augustine or John of the Cross. Now, let's see. You also got Faustina. I think you said Faustina is not a doctor of the church. And so while she's a celebrated saint and devotionalist who's inspired many people, doesn't have the same level of authority. Now, are you ready for these texts? Well, these are very different texts, and they speak to different issues and different concerns. I will tell you that, you know, early in my Catholic life, I started reading John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, and I was just bowled over and kind of devastated. And I went to Father Mark here at EWTN in the confessional, and I said, Father Mark, you know, I'm reading this Catholic mystical stuff, and it's just killing me. It's just killing me.
I can't reach that one.
And he says in his very calm Father Mark way, well, maybe you're not ready for Teresa of Avila. You know, great advice. Great advice. For my 2 cents worth, if forming your Catholic faith is what you're most interested in, start with Augustine. He's accessible. He's reliable. He's inspirational. You just can't go wrong with Augustine. You can read the Divine Comedy as literature. John of the Cross needs to be interpreted, in my judgment. There are good books on John of the Cross that will help you get into his thinking. Thomas Dubay, who deceased now, but frequent commentator and contributor to EWTN, has a book called Fire Within. You can probably get the EWTN Religious Catalog. That's a great commentary on Teresa and John and their spirituality. And then you can start working. And you might also want to get at John through Teresa. Read The Interior Castle or The Book of My Life, if that's what you're interested in.
Question to Am I Ready, which really would have to be answered by, will I be intimidated and will I feel inadequate if I read these?
Now, here, I'm gonna unburden you right now about one thing. Augustine is a brilliant writer. He was a star rhetorician in his own day. He was the equivalent of being a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist of his age. He was a fantastic writer and a great communicator. In my humble opinion, Teresa of Avila is a great doctor of the church and a terrible writer.
My sixth-grade teacher would have had red marks all over it.
Absolutely. She is an atrocious writer. Brilliant, brilliant thinker. Holy woman, guide to the spiritual life. But you, when you first pick up Teresa of Avila, you're like, I can't make heads or tails of this, and it's not your fault.
You must not be holy enough,
it's
David.
It's not your fault, right? Once I realized that, it was like the scales fell from my eyes, and I could actually enjoy her when I stopped holding her to the standards of literary perfection that I was expecting. You know, like she'll start a chapter and then put it down and come back 3 months later and not proofread and say, I forgot what I was saying, so I'll just start here. I mean, she does that kind of stuff. It's very rambling, you know. But you can get some great nuggets out of her. You really can. All right. I think we're about out of time.
This has been an interesting and fun show.
How
nice. This is a treat I never expected.
Yeah, well, Ray, thank you for being here. I wasn't expecting to see you when I showed up, so thank you for being here. Stick around. Now, we'll see you tomorrow on Call to Communion on EWTN. Thank you so much.
Bye, David.
Bye, Ray.